Today, as we begin to settle back into our seats, we're going to enter into our time to hear and respond to a message from God's Word. I had a first happen for me this morning, a first ever. I was told by someone, "Don't you dare start yet." I love it. I love it because, you know what? I love this. It is wonderful when we can be a family. And we've really discovered that God intended for His church to be just that, a family. His family. People brought together from all different walks of life, journeying together with Jesus on the road. Which is exactly what we've been talking about, what it means to journey with Jesus on the road. As He is on the road, as we've been in the Gospel of Luke, and we began several weeks ago in this Lenten season, in Luke 9:51, where it says, "When the days drew near for Him to be taken up, He set His face to go to Jerusalem." A clear and definitive statement of those of us who know the whole history given to us in the Gospels about Jesus, much like Luke did. He knew exactly what it meant writing his Gospels when he wrote this, that this journey to Jerusalem was no ordinary detour. It was no just happenstance trip. It was intentional, it was purposeful, and it wasn't just to go to Jerusalem, it was to go to the cross, to fulfill his ultimate purpose of being the Lamb of God who would take away the sins of the world. The days were drawing near for him to be taken up, directly indicating his crucifixion, his coming resurrection 3 days later, and then his ascension to be seated at the right hand of the Father. So Jesus set his face toward Jerusalem and began that journey toward the cross, a journey that ends in Luke 19:29 upon his triumphant entry into Jerusalem. All along the way from Luke 9 to 19, a big chunk of his gospel, Luke provides us with these wonderful and subtle reminders that Jesus is on the road to Jerusalem, and that he is on the road to cross, and to the cross. And in this, Jesus' ministry, his teachings, his healings continue along this road. As it's no short road. It's no hop, skip, and a jump away. But they take their time, about 3 months, it's believed, between Luke 9 to Luke 19. Much happens on this road. In each reminder we are given by Luke that they are on this road, we are taught a precious lesson and challenged with questions we must learn from and ask if we dare to even travel this road with Jesus. Questions and lessons we have asked and have sought to learn these past several weeks. Like, are we sure we want to be on this road, knowing its cost is our very life? And are we desiring the road for the right reasons, knowing it's not about us at all, but all about Him? Finally, as we talked about last week, do we understand who has power over this road? And how we can have trust in the one who has authority over all things that happen on the road, because it's Jesus Himself. None of this happens through the orchestration of man, but it happens by the will of God and only His will. Bringing us to our passage today, in Luke 17, we'll be turning to Luke 17, verses 11 through 19. And our question, that this lesson that Jesus teaches us along the road, of what it means to follow Him on the road to the cross. The question being, are we not only grateful to be part of the journey, but are we grateful to the Lord of the journey? As we turn to Luke 17, 11 through 19, we'll understand this more. On the way to Jerusalem, He was passing along between Samaria and Galilee. And as He entered a village, He was met by 10 leopards who stood at a distance and lifted up their voices saying, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us." When He saw them, He said to them, "Go and show yourselves to the priest." And as they went, they were cleansed. Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice, and he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving Him thanks. Now he was a Samaritan. Then Jesus answered, "Were not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? was no one found to return to give praise to God except this foreigner. And he said to them, him, rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well. Teaching us a hugely valuable lesson about gratitude and its nature in the people of those who choose to follow Jesus. If we wish to join Jesus on the road, particularly, there is no way to be on the road with Jesus without feeling an overwhelming sense of gratitude towards him. Gratitude and thankfulness, something that is the scarcest of virtues within humanity, especially in our own culture, even within Christianity. In virtues, they are. Fruits, they are not, as they are not listed in the 9 characteristics of the fruit of the Spirit given to us by Paul in his letters, but they are virtues nonetheless, and they're directly related to our ability to bear the fruit in its wholeness. For you cannot bear the fruit of the Spirit without gratitude, without thankfulness, because joy will be far from the life of the believer with an ungrateful heart. It can be easily said, the person who is grateful, who feels thankful for everything, will take joy in even the smallest of things. It is almost as if what our beloved sister Doreen Wilson taught me long ago is true, that gratitude would change your attitude. And boy, isn't that the truth. However, we live in a world, especially a culture, full of lament and complaint. Thankfulness is far from us in this day and age. It doesn't take long in any social interaction with any person for it to divulge into complaints. We prefer the negativity. We prefer the complaints. And this is quantifiably provable. In fact, it has been proven through studies done on social media. It has been proven that a post that has a negative comment, a negative interaction of some kind, is more likely to have likes and shares than a post that has a positive aspect to it. Especially when it comes to politics. I mean, if you say something bad about the person that someone doesn't like, boy, it's going to get all the likes and shares that you can imagine, especially in this day and age. And with the rise of this, we have to ask ourselves, why is this? Why do people attract themselves to the negative, to the complaint, to those things that just don't build up or edify, but actually tear down and destroy? Because the situation is only getting worse as time goes on. First and foremost, we must recognize that negativity fuels negativity. Then secondly, in the human mind, it has been proven it takes more positivity to outweigh the negativity of one negative statement or event. So what does that mean? That means when we are put in a negative place because of something negative happening to us, it takes more positive things to get us out of that pit. That we get stuck in that pit, and instead of trying to climb out of it, we ask for a shovel and we keep digging. Because you don't understand my lot in life. You don't understand what that person did to me. And we end up stuck in this pit of victimhood. Many have argued it's a 5-to-1 ratio. And that ratio goes up and down depending on the bend of the researcher. But they believe it takes 5 positive comments to outweigh one negative comment in the human heart. If this truly is the case, we are in a place of emotional debt in our society that is beyond fathoming, that puts our national debt to shame. And we must ask, how did we even get here in the first place? It begins with understanding the majority of Western societies like our own, for many years have lived in a world of abundance as apart from living in a world of need. For example, during the COVID-19 pandemic that recently happened, our nation's greatest scarcity that we faced was the lack of toilet paper. When there are places in this world that doesn't even have toilets, yet alone toilet paper. I heard it once said, to the one who has everything, it is hard for them to be thankful for anything, and yet desire to have more of what they already have. Always striving, always yearning for more, not being able to be satisfied in what they have already been given. In other words, we fail to be thankful for what we have because we never have experienced need or going without, typically in our culture. This is not the case for God's people and those who would dare to join Jesus on the road. We must realize, as followers of Jesus, we are not immune to the epidemic of ungratefulness in the human heart. We are not immune to the pains and sorrows of this life, as those that afflict others afflict us as well. Sadly, it's very true what one commentator said about this passage. Apart from quick, hasty, half-hearted prayers of thanks at meals, no one would ever know Christians are grateful people, much less recipients of divine healing grace. This ought to never be the case. And is opposed to what we are called to be. You know, the Bible tells us time and time again that we're supposed to have thankful hearts. Paul says in Philippians 4:4, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. And this is in the midst of persecution. If we remember, Paul writes this while he's in prison for working for the Lord, doing what God called him to do. He's in prison. And he says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. In Romans 1:21, Paul describes the condemning wrath that God is bringing on unrepentant and unrighteous hearts. And one of the reasons is their lack of thanks. For it says, for though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. And then you have 2 Timothy 3:2, where Paul warns Timothy about the coming age of godlessness and explains how gratitude and gratefulness will be absent. He says, for people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy. In seeing this, it is clear a life of ingratitude in the life of a believer is antithetical, incompatible, and completely contradictory to the calling given to the believer to live a life of separation from this world. However, sadly but true, as I quoted earlier, apart from quick, hasty, half-hearted prayers of thanks at meals, no one would ever know Christians are grateful people, much less recipients of divine healing grace. This moment in Luke's gospel on the road with Jesus is a powerful teaching to those who would think being thankless and a follower of Christ is possible. Because it's not. It is not possible for someone to be thankless and also a follower of Jesus. Because to be with Jesus on the road is to be one who gives thanks, who rejoices always, as Paul would say. Again, he would say, rejoice. This moment on the road with Jesus shows us this. Understanding those costs. Understanding what is sacrificed to be on the road, because we understand how the reward far outweighs those costs, because we understand what the actual reward is, and that's an eternity with him. In this, we know that we're on the road for the right reasons, and we give thanks for that. And there's no other response whenever we're on that road for the right reason but this. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, God, for looking upon me and saying, follow me. There's no other response but praise. There's no other response but gratitude every day, not just on Sunday. Praise and gratitude toward the one who invited us to join him on the road. This is what we see happening here in Luke, starting with verses 11 and 12 of chapter 17. On the way to Jerusalem, he was passing along between Samaria and Galilee. And as he entered a village, he was met by 10 lepers who stood at a distance. Along this journey Jesus is on towards the cross, Luke and only Luke will teach us about this account of Jesus' life, ministry, death, and resurrection. Luke and only Luke, in telling the gospel, gives us this moment on this outskirts of this unknown, unnamed town that lies between the border of Samaria and Galilee. Why is knowing that important, that Luke and only Luke writes this? It's important because Luke is believed, out of the three synoptics, which is a fancy word we give for similar, synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the three similar gospels, Luke is believed to be the last one that was written. meaning that Luke had Mark and Matthew at his disposal. He had Matthew and Mark in hand and in mind when he wrote his gospel. And Luke thought that this moment was so important for us to grasp, for us to understand as believers, that he made sure to pin it in his gospel. Understanding the purpose of Luke's gospel is written in the very first part of Luke, in the very first chapter, in the very first four verses, where it says, "Insomuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the world, the word that have delivered them to, ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught." Luke writes this so that we would have certainty. We would have certainty in who Jesus is and the things that he has taught. This is the whole point of this, which makes this moment all the more significant for us, to understand that Luke gives this to us so that we can have certainty of the things we have been taught. In this, we can see that Luke thought this moment, once again, was so pivotal that he had to include it when Matthew and Mark doesn't include it. Luke saw something imperative here and wanted to be sure that generations of followers of Jesus would see it. Something imperative to see in these 10 unidentified leprous men standing before Jesus, most likely in various stages of decay and most likely in various forms of with skin diseases, because at this time period, leprosy could have been anything. That it could be a rash, it could be just anything. They would say, "You're leprous, you have to go outside the camp." They would have been cast out of society until whatever disease they had would cure. But unfortunately, whenever you put someone that has one skin disease with another person that has another skin disease, what tends to happen when you put two sick people with two different sicknesses together? They both get sick. And they transmit their sickness to one another. So you may have been sent out into a leper colony because you had shingles, and you end up getting scabies while you're out there. And your second condition is worse than the first condition because now it's compounding. And then there's other people that are coming out, and you're contracting their diseases. And it's not a good place to be. There really is no hope for these 10 lepers. They are sitting out there in tattered clothing, torn clothing. You could probably see their skeletal structure through their malnourished flesh. And we understand that it was the law of this time for the Jews to do this. For anyone who had have a case of leprosy, you removed them from the camp, as Leviticus 13:45 says, and you made them wear torn clothes. It says this in 13:45 of Leviticus, "The leprous person who has the disease shall wear torn clothes, and let the hair of his head hang loose, and he shall cover his upper lip and cry, 'Unclean, unclean,'" much like we made George do when we were in Honduras and he had COVID. He did that on his own will and inclination, but but can you picture this for a moment, though? As Jesus is entering this town with a large entourage of followers behind him, they encounter these 10 lepers outside the village, living in a colony of lepers together. And when you think about it, their colonizing together only would have made, once again, their condition worse. But they're together because they share in common humanity with one another. And that's something that we cannot forget, that these people, they're humans, and they need help. Hence their cry, "Master, have mercy on us." They most likely looked like they were climbing out of their graves, but they were fully alive, breathing, heart beating. They had emotions, feelings, and souls. They had loved ones that they longed to be with again, but could not. Giving all the more context to that cry, "Have mercy on us." Once Jesus saw them, he immediately responds, it says in verse 14. "When he saw them, he said to them, 'Go and show yourself to the priest.' And as they went, they were cleansed." It's important to note, this is not the first time Jesus has encountered a leper. And it is not the first time he would heal a leper. Luke 5, 12, 13, we see such a moment. While he was in one of the cities, there came a man full of leprosy. And when he saw Jesus, he fell on his face and begged him, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I will be clean." And immediately the leprosy left him. Which is two verses that text that we could spend an entire day in. However, for today, it's important for us to note the differences here. Because these two encounters with Jesus and lepers is different. There is no touch given, nor a pronouncement to be clean. Jesus just told them to go and do what was prescribed for them according to the law of Moses if their leprosy had been cleansed. Can anyone see the interesting thing here in verse 14 about what Jesus tells them to go do? When he saw them, he said to them, "Go and show yourselves to the priest." And as they went, they were cleansed. Can anybody notice the order of operations here? What do we see? They were cleansed as they began going to the priest. Exactly. They weren't cleansed by Jesus and then told to go. He said, "No, just go. Just go." Jesus tells them to go before their healing had even begun. Jesus tells them to have faith they would be healed, faith that they would be cleansed, so to go and do what was required of them. In showing themselves to the priest, as Leviticus chapter 14, if you'd like to read that later, lays out for us what it is the leper was actually supposed to do. And in this, they would undergo an 8-day ceremony. An 8-day ceremony of purification that would allow them to reunite with their friends, their family, and society once again. I mean, that's a pretty joyful thing when you think about it. But imagine the faith it took these lepers to just turn and make the first step. Jesus, do you not see, like, I still don't have fingers. And, you know, that's going to be an automatic disqualification. My skin still looks like scales. I mean, what's going on here? Luke makes it clear that they weren't cleansed before they had the term. But when one decided, "You know what, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to do that." He started with that slow leper limp, which became a full stride, which became a full complete sprint and joyous laughter and shouting, "I am healed, I have been healed." As he drew closer and closer to Jerusalem, stubby nubs became whole. Skin that was like scales fell off and regrew in its place. Eyelashes returned to their place. There was a hairline. Boy, I would love to have a full hairline again. I see them looking at one another thinking, "We have all these wounds," and we're decaying. As one turns and starts shouting in joy for the healing, and another one turns, and then another one, as they each activate the faith in one another, as they see one another being healed at the simple word of Jesus to have faith and to go and show themselves. This was no smoke or mirrors. This was a dramatic change of life. It was a new birth that day, right there on the road to Jerusalem. All happening as they went in faith in the words Jesus gave. Noting all were healed, and there is no doubt all of them were thankful, very thankful for their healing. However, there then is this distinction made in verse 15 and 16, a clear distinction about the thankfulness between one amongst the other nine. It says, "Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice, and he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. Now he was a Samaritan." There is no doubt all 10 were thankful. I guarantee you, they were all just praising God in full sprint on their way to the priest so that they could be back with their family. The idea of stopping to catch their breath or even stopping to turn around wasn't even in their mind. It was incomprehensible to them. Yet one does stop in his running. One does stop in his heading to the priest. And he stops to praise God with a loud voice. And not only does he do that, he stops to come back to Jesus and thank Jesus for what Jesus has done. And we got to understand, this one was a Samaritan. Luke makes a point to point this out. He was a Samaritan. And it's believed the other nine were Jews. And how we know the other nine were Jews is because of what Jesus tells them to go do. to go see the priest. If they were Gentiles, there would be no such need of religious ceremony. They could just go back to their lives in society. But the point is, those who should have understood what was happening didn't catch it. But there's the one, the Samaritan, who does. And we've discussed in the past, Samaritans had no dealing with the Jews. They were embittered enemies of one another and considered apostate and scum by one another. Yet the common affliction and misery brought these 10 together into a suffering community of support and care for one another. It was him, a foreigner, who turned and did something that the other 9 did not. It was the outsider, according to the Jew, who gave thanks not just for what had been done, but to the one who did it. It was the outsider who allowed his ceremonial obligations to be overridden by his spiritual bliss, to fall down at the feet of Jesus, giving him all the praise, honor, and glory for what had been done, knowing that healing would not have happened or taken place had there not been Jesus. Do not misunderstand here. He is thankful for his healing. He is very thankful, and there's nothing wrong with being thankful for healing. There's nothing wrong with being thankful for when God breaks into our lives. There's nothing wrong with that. But what's wrong is when we place that gratitude above our gratitude just for him, for who he is, as we sang, I will worship you for who you are today. We are to worship him for who he is, not because of what he does. Sure, we worship him because of the things he does. They're worth worshiping him for. But there's so much more worth worshiping Jesus for than just what he has done. He is grateful for Jesus above and over what Jesus has done and brought to his life, which is why he returns to thank Jesus. In this, the Samaritan who returns may not have seen Jesus for who Jesus was, but recognized Jesus as God's agent to what had happened. And for this, he gave thanks to him. In this, Jesus further points this reality out, and we're faced with it with these three very rhetorical but very difficult questions. Then Jesus answered, "Were not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Was no one found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner?" I just love how Jesus teaches us so much with questions, even rhetorical questions that aren't meant to be answered. Because we know that they're meant to prove something. They're meant to teach us something, not to be answered, but more to make us go, oh, you're right. It's just like he's reinforcing something he had taught earlier in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 7, whenever a woman who is known as a great sinner comes and washes his feet with her tears and her hair. And we see this moment where Simon the Pharisee, who invited Jesus over, questions why Jesus would allow such a sinful woman to even touch him. Jesus says this, "A certain moneylender had 2 debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more?" Simon answered, "The one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt." And he said to him, "You have judged rightly." Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little." Lord, have mercy on us for thinking that we are more than what we really are. Help us see our deep need of you and respond accordingly in desperation of you. Jesus asked 3 difficult questions. We can see Jesus' disappointment here in what the other 9 Jews had missed out on that the foreign Samaritan had gained beyond healing. Because he gained something beyond healing that day. And it's in Jesus' words in verse 19. And he said to him, "Rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well." And there's an interesting thing we've discovered about the original Greek here. this phrase, your faith has made you well, that last phrase. In the original Greek, many scholars are now arguing with the newer manuscripts that we have, your faith has saved you, is what Jesus actually said. This idea of being made well was being saved. Salvation, redemption, restoration to God. In fact, very authoritative translations of the Bible, like modern ones, call it like the CSB, the Christian Standard Bible. I mean, just that's how they translate this passage now. Your faith has saved you, giving us a better understanding of what Jesus is actually doing with this leper. He's not just giving him a physical healing. He's healing his spirit. He's healing his soul. He's reconciling the relationship that was broken because of his sin. And only this one receives that blessing. It's because this one understands who it is who does it. Who it is who is capable. He's not just thankful for the healing, but he's thankful for the one who brings about the healing. Because here's the reality. The day was going to come where all 10 of those leopards' mortal shells would fall. They were alive and well now, but the day was coming where they would go about the way that all living things in this world of sin goes due to sin, and that is death. They would go to the grave. We will all face death in this life. But thanks be to God for Jesus Christ, because death is not the end. We know that death is the beginning. It is the new birth. All 10 of these lepers would face death, even though they faced healing this day. One of them would face life everlasting because he realized his deepest need. And you see, when we fail to realize our deepest need and to be thankful for Jesus, for who he is, and we're thankful for the gift, what are we going to do when the gift's gone? What are we going to do when the mortar shell begins to fail? If we're not thankful in the one who can bring restoration, if we're not thankful in the one who can bring salvation, what are we going to be thankful in when our restoration is far from us? When we breathe that last breath? It is so important for us, brothers and sisters, to be thankful in the one who has done it, who has accomplished it. And Jesus reminds us here through this moment, and Luke makes sure that we know this, that it is more important for us to be thankful in the one than what he has done. To be thankful for who Jesus is, not just for what he has done. Making us ask, what or who are you thankful for? What or who are you showing gratitude in? Not that there's nothing wrong with showing gratitude and thankfulness for what has been done. But when that gratitude and thankfulness outweighs the gratefulness and thankfulness to the one who has done it, there is a great problem. We must ever be mindful to not only be grateful for the journey that we're on with Jesus, but to be even more grateful for the master of our journey, which is Jesus. Because without him, there is only one road and one highway we can traverse, for the AC/DC fans out there. But because of him, there is now a stairway we can all climb. I digress. We must ask that cutting and deep question that this moment on the road with Jesus demands us to ask, is, are we truly grateful in the one who's made it all possible? The praise to God, the Father, and Jesus the Son is always at the heart of an authentic faith. Passages throughout the New Testament shows us this. And in fact, on your Going Deeper sheet inside your worship folders, these are all listed. 1 Corinthians 15:57, 2 Corinthians 2:14, 9:15, Colossians 1:11 through 14, and 3:17 are just a few. But those passages are listed if you'd like to go and reference those and look those up. And I encourage you to do this and dwell on those in light of the meaning of what we've studied today in this moment of Jesus on the road. Knowing the authentic heart of a true believer praises and glorifies God in who he is, not just in what he has done. Knowing Jesus is the reason we can even be grateful in the first place. In this, in light of the world we live in, it also becomes a clear distinguishing factor of whose we are. It becomes a clear and distinguishing factor that we belong to him. Knowing that ungratefulness and a life of Christ are incompatible. We could take heart now knowing that gratitude will change our attitude, but more so, it will change our life. Because thankfulness and things that we struggle with in this world are incompatible. Things like anxiety and depression, they're incompatible. And in fact, when we can learn to muster out just thankfulness for the smallest of things, we can find joy in everything. Even when it would seem like there's nothing to be thankful around us, we can lift ourselves out of that pit of negativity this world has put us in by just saying, God, I know who you are, and I know that this mess isn't all there is. Thank you. Thank you not only for what you've done, thank you for who you are. This is our lesson today from Jesus on the road. This is the word of the Lord. The grass withers and the flowers fade, but the word of the Lord remains forever.